Moncrief on News Talk.
Now, I've been kind of teasing you with the Irish flappers, but it's a truly incredible story. So most people might not be aware, but Ireland did revel in the Roaring Twenties. We had burgeoning dance halls, a thriving jazz scene, and yes, we even had Irish flappers. Joining me now is Louise Ryan, Professor of Sociology at the University of Greenwich and co-editor with Dr. Eileen Hogan of UCC of Flappers and the Jazz Age, Women and Leisure in Ireland in the 1920s to 1930s. Louise, how are you today?
Hello, Tom. Yeah, very well. Thank you.
I'm so glad you wrote this. I had no idea of this age. I had no idea of these Irish women who appear to be absolutely legendary. They seem to be almost written out of our history, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, the image we have of Irish history, particularly in the early 20th century, is certainly not one that emphasises fun and entertainment and leisure. It's quite a sad history in many ways, and we're not in any sense trying to undermine that part of the Irish story, but we're just going for a bit of balance here to say that Irish people also went to the cinema, went dancing, enjoyed wearing nice clothes, and had a bit of fun along the way.
And this was during the 20s and 30s, which it's not an era we talk of very much culturally in Ireland, because I've always been very struck that at times it seems like the 60s didn't really get here, never mind the 20s or 30s. I'm not joking.
No, it's true. That's one of the reasons why we've brought together this lovely collection with all the fantastic authors who've contributed around this topic, because there was a thriving cinema industry, thriving dance halls. You know, when you think about it, one of the reasons why the bishops were so exercised about, you know, clamouring for dance hall controls, clamoring for censorship, was precisely because those things were so popular in the 1920s and 30s. So it's very important that we shine a light on that part of our history as well.
Right. So this jazz world, it was more or less coming from America, wasn't it? It was American jazz, and it was black music going into that and influencing it. And it was brilliant. But we were getting it here.
Oh, absolutely. And throughout the book, we have lots of different sources that we use to try to piece together this hidden history, and particularly the work that Eileen Hogan has done with Ruth Stanley, using all the archive sources and newspaper sources to track down who were the jazz bands, where were they playing, what parts of Ireland were they touring. And from that story emerges some wonderful women jazz leaders. I mean, we can think of the likes of Josephine Mitchell, for example, yeah, who became very famous internationally and ended up becoming very well known in Berlin as Baby Mitchell and her female queens of jazz band. And then we have the other great leading exponent of jazz, Peggy Dell. Now, I'm sure I'm a bit older than you, Tom, but as a child, I remember Peggy Dell on the television. She was a very, very elderly lady then, but she appeared on the telly on RTE playing the piano. But she was a huge star of jazz in the 20s and 30s.
And when she'd be, where would she get to play? What would those gigs be like?
Well, they were traveling all over the country, not just in big cities like Dublin and Belfast and Cork. But we have examples in the book, for example, of the Marine Hotel in Kilkee, County Clare, which had a jazz band for its summer residency, which was hugely popular and received rave reviews in the local newspapers. So we can say from County Clare throughout the whole of the country, these jazz bands were touring, they were playing regularly, they were getting great reviews, and they were popular. This was a successful model. Otherwise, it wouldn't have lasted as long as it did.
So they were seeing the gigs and people were playing and musicians were playing. They were seeing the films as well. And the films were quite liberal, really, weren't they?
They were. And this is something that we kind of need to remember about the 1920s, that these were the silent movies. So they were very international, not just from Hollywood, but because language wasn't a barrier. There were films coming from Germany and all over the world, really. And this was before censorship really caught on. In a way, the film industry was kind of ahead of the curve and the censors were not quite catching up with them. So the old black and white silent movies in the 20s were quite risque, quite a lot of nudity, quite sexually explicit. And it was only in the 30s that censorship really clamped down on how liberal those films were. So, you know, it was possible for Irish audiences in the 20s, where cinemas were being built all over the country, to see some fairly risque films.
It all sounds slightly Father Ted, doesn't it? down with this sort of thing. But somebody, I see one of the films promised, you'll get an earful and you'll also catch an eyeful.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, it was a very international culture. And I think this is the thing that we need to remember about Ireland in the 20s and 30s, that it wasn't an island, if you'll pardon the pun. It was very much connected into the wider fashion industry, the music industry, travel. Tourism was really taking off at that time, with a lot of encouragement from the Irish government, who was actively promoting tourism. So Ireland was very much connected to the global cultural trends in the 20s. And, you know, when you think about it, it makes sense that those influences would have been coming across the Atlantic and coming across from Europe as well. And fashion, you know, we have other chapters in the book that deal with fashion and the burgeoning of department stores and all over the country. But I think it's also important to mention, Tom, that this was not just something that was reserved for the wealthy or the upper middle classes in places like Dublin or wherever. But we also have this fascinating chapter in the book which deals with mail order dressmaking. And one of our contributors, Sheila Hunt, has done some lovely work tracing the history of these mail order patterns, so that you could order these patterns through magazines and newspapers to make your own dress if you couldn't afford to buy one. And so stay up to fashion on a budget. So we can really see the appetite for this kind of thing throughout the
country. That was really, that was kind of a part of our culture. I can remember my mom talking about people sending off for patterns for dresses and recreating something they'd seen somewhere else. Obviously, Ireland at this point is in, well, it's kind of awkwardly placed, isn't it? Because it's just achieved independence. And whether it's a strictly Catholic country is a big issue for it, isn't it?
Yeah, and we can see in the newspapers, particularly, and the chapter that I've written with Rachel Sayers, which where we look at both the north and the south of the border. In that chapter, we can see almost that kind of tug of war that was going on. Sometimes on the same page of the newspaper, you'd have a priest or a bishop lambasting modern fashion and the low morality of young women and the corrupting influences of the cinema coming in from abroad. And on the very same page, you'd have a huge advertisement for the latest fashions in the local department store, and indeed advertisements for the local for the latest film showing in your local cinema. So that complete contradiction, we can see that kind of almost battle for moral superiority playing out in the newspapers. And it, interestingly, not just in the South, but also in the North, we see that similar kind of tussle about what it really meant to be modern or to be traditional at that point in history.
Yeah, they seem to be North and South at each other's, at odds with each other, to see who can be the most conservative, it seems. I'm seeing a quote there from A.M. Carlyle, a one-time shipping director of Harland & Wolff, saying, "Modern women were tobogganing to hell." Listening to Charles music. And not to be outdone, the Catholic Bishop of Derry, Charles McHugh, said, "For a girl to be called modern today is another way of saying she is pagan. She must use the dress of the pagan, disfigure her young face with the paint of barbarism, and pretend to take delight in the dance of the savage."
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's a great flavour of the kind of tone that we see in the book. But what we really wanted to show with this book is the agency of women. You know, they weren't just kowtowing to the bishops and the priests. They were expressing themselves. And that wasn't always easy. You know, they may have disapproving looks, but nonetheless, you could see that they were, and we've got lots of lovely photographs from newspapers of the era, where you can see the young women going off to dances, enjoying themselves and wearing up-to-date 1920s.
Wow. I'm reminded of something Jerry Ryan said when they were describing scenes at Fela to him, where people were drinking and cavorting and, you know, going asleep in phone booths. And he said, "You know, that sounds like someone's idea of a great weekend." I'm thinking it's the same for the taking delight in the dance of the savage. Thank you very much for that. I'm afraid we're beaten by the clock, but fantastic work and very timely as well. Louise, thank you very much indeed.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.